Don't have enough time to sit down and read all the best Bitcoin articles? Well, let us read them for you. This is a Cryptoconomy Quick Read. What is up, guys? Welcome back to the show. We are jumping in. I think I've decided to, even though Loop just got released from Lightning Labs, which I really kind of want to dig into that one, but I haven't actually read the post on the Lightning Labs blog yet. I've just been kind of scouring GitHub. So I'm really excited about that, but I think I have still decided to go ahead and just hit parts 2 through 4 of the BitTorrent lessons for crypto. Part 2 is pretty short here. I think it's Medium says it's only a 5-minute read, so probably be 8 minutes on the show here. But if you have not checked it out, BOS, I'm not sure what that stands for, but BOS scores have just been released for by Lightning Labs. Alex Bosworth posted this. So there are now basically node ratings and like weighting scores coming to LND for like the autopilot management. So that's really exciting, as autopilot will now basically, we're starting to build out the tools for autopilot to decide what is a good and useful channel versus a unreliable or low value channel. And as those tools, those will probably come in baby steps. It'll probably be, a bunch of little things like this, but basically scoring and weighing other nodes on the network, like with connectivity uptime and that type of thing, is the beginning of having an autopilot decide when to close a channel on your behalf and open one with someone else, and how to avoid certain, or why to avoid certain nodes or a route that may or may not be worth the cost. So that's really, really exciting development. And that, in combination with Loop, which was just released. Loop is basically a I'm not sure how the actual service is run. I'm real curious to dig more into this. Like I said, I've only really kind of skimmed the surface of this. But Loop is essentially a way to self-manage your, using submarine swaps with other people on the network. Loop basically allows you to create your own capacity or fund routes on and off of the Lightning network by using using HTLC. So you're using submarine swaps to get on and off the Lightning network so that you can basically make your own capacity in a 100% trustless way. So that's really, really exciting because there's been a number of services that have been doing this for a while, like Bitrefill, Lightning Hood has one now. There's a bunch of them. Zigzag. I've got a little collection of a list of ones that do exactly this type of thing, but this is one to basically, this is one that you're installing, like LoopD is the, you're installing this on the client side, and you're actually managing all of this from your side. You're basically like running the commands or whatever and picking which nodes or service provider you want to use based on like a subset of information. But this is just really, really exciting because it's going to start. This is the beginnings of having the Lightning network and the Bitcoin network really talk to each other, because right now they feel pretty separate. Like I've got strictly my Bitcoin wallet and strictly my Lightning wallet, and they don't really interact. But all the capacity there to make a Bitcoin transaction that just makes something happen on the Lightning network, and then vice versa, a Lightning network transaction that makes something happen on the Bitcoin network. Like once those tools are fully integrated and put in the background of things, essentially whatever payment is necessary, like whatever script or type of transactions necessary to make the payment or essentially the goal of whatever you're attempting to do, like whichever is the best option, that the client can simply do that for you. Whether it means a submarine swap for someone else to pay a Bitcoin transaction, or paying a Bitcoin transaction to a submarine swap to have someone else pay a Lightning transaction for you, it's going to be one of those things where at some point your wallet is just choosing which one to do to get it done the fastest and the cheapest. And it's just really awesome to, like, it's a perfect example of a Lightning Network service that can happen completely in the background that never compromises your sovereignty. Like, you're still 100% you're still 100% in control. It's all hashed from the pre-image that you create and give to them. So it's still, you know, HTLCs, and it's just so exciting to think they're just going to start behaving as one. And when that becomes fluid, you're going to see the cost, like the on-chain burden of all these transactions, like your Lightning Network wallet in conjunction with something like with this built in is just going to work all the time, and you're not really going to know why. And again, I still think we're a long way from that, but it's just, you know, these baby steps, you can see how, okay, this is going to solve this problem. This is going to be a solution here. And eventually Autopilot is going to be able to understand and account for all of this in a way that is good enough for the average user. And sovereignty may really be fingers crossed, a relatively download your client and it works type thing. So that's just a really exciting development. I just retweeted that just a little while ago. So if you have not checked that out, Lightning Labs blog, I think it's blog.lightninglabs.com. I don't know what I did with the tab. I might have already put it in my spreadsheet for stuff to read and left it there. You know, I'll put it in the show notes for today, since I'm talking so much about Lightning at the beginning of the show. Definitely something to check out. But don't want to waste any more time, because this is actually a quick read episode with part two of BitTorrent Lessons for Crypto. And this one is titled, If You're Not Breaking Rules, You're Doing It Wrong. So let's go ahead and just jump right in, and we will chat about this one a little bit afterward. You know what? Let's go ahead and hit, actually. I'm going to get another coffee, and let's take a break right now and hit our sponsor. All right, so quick recap. If you did not listen to yesterday's episode, this whole series is by Simon Morris, which I will link to the entire Medium series and also link to his Twitter page. And this is he worked for BitTorrent Incorporated for, I believe it was 10 years, which was covered in yesterday's article. And he went over just kind of the impact that BitTorrent had, like why did it matter? And he went through a lot of its history and how it managed to essentially avoid a lot of the legal challenges. It didn't avoid any legal challenges. It avoided outright legal bans. But it's a really good introduction into the history of BitTorrent and why it matters, and kind of what lessons we can learn for Bitcoin and crypto. And this is part two. After covering kind of an introduction to BitTorrent and its history and some of the challenges that it had during its early days, now we are talking about decentralization and why BitTorrent was so powerful with part two, If You're Not Breaking Rules, You're Doing It Wrong. BitTorrent Lessons for Crypto 2 of 4. So without further ado, let's go ahead and jump in to part two. Following my first post on why BitTorrent mattered, it is worth reflecting a little on the popular theme of decentralization. what it actually means in the particular context of blockchains, and what it's useful for. What's the point of decentralization anyway? Decentralization, at least the way it happened in BitTorrent, really means the combination of two qualities, technical decentralization and organizational decentralization. Technical decentralization means that there's no single choke point in an application or on the network that can be attacked, which will lead to the system being compromised or switched off. Organizational decentralization means there is no single person or entity that can be compelled to compromise or switch off the network. In the case of the BitTorrent ecosystem, this was certainly the case. The distribution of the architecture of BitTorrent across client software and any number of torrent sites and tracker nodes meant that once a critical mass of people was using the technology, there was really no single place to attack that would have compromised or shut down the network. Furthermore, with the technology being opened up so early, there were a range of companies and individuals who developed all of the components that made BitTorrent work. There was no technical place which could be used, and no person or organization which could be compelled to switch off the network. It was very hard indeed to censor, at least within the democratic norms that governed the most influential state actors on the early internet. This level of decentralization gave rise to the critical third component that makes this type of decentralization so intoxicating and exciting. An ability to break the rules. While a decentralized architecture can be effective at routing around a variety of different failures in a network, the type of decentralization that was achieved by BitTorrent, and by Bitcoin for that matter, has enabled routing around rules. In BitTorrent, this happened quite by accident. The original objectives of BitTorrent, unlike the stated aims of Bitcoin, were not explicitly to enable the type of rule-breaking that ensued. Nevertheless, rule-breaking did ensue on an epic scale in the form of very widespread sharing of copyrighted files, and it has persisted for a very long time in the face of fierce and well-funded opposition from those who own copyrights. This point is broadly applicable to Bitcoin and many of the projects that are setting out to leverage blockchain technologies. It's pointless to argue about what decentralization is or how decentralized various projects are and why that even matters without first talking about what decentralization does. Decentralization, in the sense it is applied to blockchain technologies, isn't really about the multi-homing of infrastructure or the sharding or sharing of databases. Decentralization in this sense means creating an uncensorable system that enables the unfettered breaking of rules. This is why the promise of blockchain is so disruptive. The blockchain, as embodied by Bitcoin and further enumerated by Ethereum, is the quintessential technology of disruption. Once launched, it cannot be stopped, come what may. Without this sort of rule-breaking, whether by accident or design, it's quite hard to imagine why decentralized blockchain technology even matters. It's a distributed data store with a complicated and slow update mechanism. While there are some qualities of blockchain architectures that are useful short of full decentralization, they hardly justify for the wilder, quote, biggest thing since the internet, excitement. The one value proposition that everyone seems to agree on for blockchain technologies is that they are censor-proof, and this matters only if you have something that someone wants to censor. To my mind, the most interesting blockchain projects out there are the ones that enable the breaking of rules. Through this lens, there has really only been one seriously exciting application of blockchain technology so far. That is its application in capital formation, mainly through the use of initial coin offerings, or ICOs. The rules around capital formation in the U.S. and the updates with the 2012 Jobs Act are complex and well-intentioned, and I don't mean to debate them here. I certainly don't want to defend the bad behavior that happened as a result of the ICO boom, but two things stick out clearly. One, the ICO boom happened in an ungoverned way and was, albeit briefly, wildly successful in raising billions of dollars to fund a broad range of projects. Two, ICOs have now almost completely stalled as a result of pressure from the SEC and other regulatory bodies around the world. Other than this example, there are a few planned projects, but very little actual rule-breaking is going on. It seems reasonable to assume that if rules are being broken, then someone somewhere is going to care. And yet there's little evidence of anyone directly, quote, feeling the heat of rule-breaking behavior enabled by decentralized blockchain systems in the same way that media industry execs once felt the heat of the rule-breaking taking place in the BitTorrent ecosystem. Not that every blockchain project needs to be breaking rules. There are many important projects that exist to build the fabric of this industry. But I'm pretty sure that the gold in this particular gold rush is the ability to architect systems without central controls, which enable participants to break rules with impunity. When observers decry the lack of adoption, the reason why adoption is missing is that there are worryingly few projects that are breaking rules that large numbers of people actively want to be broken. A groundswell of utility being realized is clearly missing. In the early days of BitTorrent, this meant millions of people simply downloading the latest movie for free from the Pirate Bay without any DRM wrapper spoiling their enjoyment, without that annoying "you'll go to jail if you violate copyrights" page that was inflicted upon every legal viewer but conveniently stripped out of all the bootleg copies. For a while, the experience of BitTorrent was strictly better than any other online experience, and it was free. The closest to this we have come in the blockchain ecosystem is a legion of investors hoping to get rich on the expectation of some killer app coming along. The expectation itself relies on some utility emerging somewhere else. Unless and until this sort of utility does emerge, then the ecosystem remains vulnerable to accusations of being just a Ponzi scheme and may yet collapse entirely. The general purpose public blockchains out there might be best understood as platforms for rule-breaking apps. If there are no rules being broken, it becomes tempting to ask why a decentralized architecture is the best tool for the job. If I were an investor, I'd be asking any apps or dApps on top of these platforms the question, what rules are you breaking? The third post is on the problem of intent, the cost of complexity, and the governance paradox. All right, and there we have it with part two of BitTorrent Lessons for Crypto. If you're not breaking the rules, you're doing it wrong. This is a powerful example for explaining why that there is any utility, why there was any utility with BitTorrent, and a really interesting lens with which to view Bitcoin and crypto history, like things that have already happened. Though I have to admit, I was a little surprised when I first read this that Simon Morris seemed to think that the only major rule breaking going on in the crypto space was in ICOs. Even though he's right about that, in my opinion, I don't think it's at all the core of the rules being broken in the system, but I do think he's right in that theory that absolutely this is about breaking the rules, or at least from that frame, I think there is a lot to be discussed about Bitcoin and cryptocurrency and its history. So let's hit our new sponsor real fast before we get into all of the reasons, all of the things that I think Simon did not mention where I think Bitcoin and cryptocurrency as a tool is actually breaking a ton of rules. So, first and foremost, currency is all about rules. Inflationary monetary policy is essentially a way to force people to fund with their savings the projects and goals of their governments. And this is without needing their direct consent. So, the most powerful rule being broken in Bitcoin is that it's a refusal, whether they are knowingly doing it or not, to fund government debt with your labor. If you are not saving your production value in the government currency, then they are not taking its value for funding their projects. Now, again, this does not have to be a conscious thing. People can simply like see or like look at the value of their savings and see that it is either rising when it's in Bitcoin, or that it's holding better than the other currency, and simply choose to migrate for that reason, not realizing that a part of that holding of value or that rising of value is the fact that you're not paying the inflationary fee. That this is a non-inflationary alternative to route around the slow and never-ending cost that comes out of the that's stolen in its purchasing power by the nation state. And another huge part of those kind of the monetary rules, the monetary restrictions, is kind of something like KYC AML. This is why I really think decentralized exchanges are going to have a place, even though they all seem to be kind of crap right now. I've been kind of exploring a lot of the different projects, and I don't know if any of the ones with tokens are going to make any sense at all. There's still a lot of work being done, and I hope the major limitations to a network effect are actually going to be worked out soon. I've been watching BISC very closely, and hopefully, I think it was actually BitSquare originally. I think that's what it's, BISQ, BISC. So if you haven't checked that one out, I would encourage you to explore that a little bit. Volume is really low still, at least the last time I checked. But I'm very curious to see how that unfolds, particularly if some countries start cracking down on exchanges more tightly, or instituting some other controls or limitations for certain subsets of people. Like they start doing the, oh, you have to be an accredited investor type bullshit. But having value outside of the direct line of government sight is a powerful rule for that's positioned very well in the cryptocurrency system to be broken. Like your neighbor, like just somebody in your neighborhood, obviously has no right to look at all of your savings accounts and investment accounts, where you spend your money and who you do business with, because obviously they could choose to harm you. They could attack you socially, or they could blackmail you with some of this information if it's embarrassing or very private. This is why privacy is a right. Because you should not have to trust someone else with that level of information. You shouldn't have to expose yourself and open yourself to attack just to satisfy their desire to judge you or see what it is that you're doing with money that you earned, that you've voluntarily traded with somebody else, to make sure that they know that you're not doing something that they disagree with. Like, who cares whether or not they disagree with it? And this is the same reason the government never had this right at the beginning of the U.S. It wasn't until income tax was implemented in, what was it, early 1900s? I can't remember when the income tax was. But it wasn't until the income tax that the government was like, oh, well, if you're not telling us where all your money is, it's because you're stealing it from us, because we're allowed to steal your money. This is why government. This is why privacy is a right, and why, as soon as you give the government the right to take money that you have earned, to direct your labor, you lose the right to privacy. Because, well, the government has to know, because otherwise you might not be paying what the government says you owe them. And the government is actually far more likely to use this knowledge to confiscate your funds or limit who and where you can do business, and to tell you what you should do with that value, far more likely than your neighbor. Like, your neighbor might still do something, but the government is basically, that's the reason they want to invade your privacy, is so that they can make sure that you're doing exactly what they want you to do with your money. So someone else directing, under the threat of force or violence, what was earned with your labor and your body and your time is slavery, plain and simple. That's why slavery is a bad thing. It's a declaration by someone else, backed by their lack of respect for you, your time, and your body, and who you are, to say that I am going to hurt you if you do not use your body, your life, and your time to accomplish my goals instead of yours. That's slavery. And it can look like a million different things. It doesn't have to come with whips and cotton picking. It can come with guns or written warnings and bills of debt and just really soft, you know, if you don't do this, you know, we're going to have consequences. You know, we're going to talk to your parents. So the freedom to choose what labor you want to engage in may be there, like this country. Like, I can choose where I put my labor and how I earn my living, but I still cannot choose. I still have a very massive subset of my time and my production that has to go to their goals instead of mine. And it's pretty clear that I don't own my body and my life in this scenario, because if I refuse to, well, they will simply lock me in a cage and steal my life from me. They'll take all my belongings. They'll ruin my relationships. They'll lock me away in a cage. I won't even get to see the sun. And if I refuse, or if I try to challenge them and fight off my attacker, they'll just kill me. So it's obvious that if you think about it for just 20 seconds about the entire process, if you don't fund their goals, if you don't fund their subsidies, if you don't pay Walmart what government wants to pay Walmart, if you don't, you know, pay for killing the right brown people in the right country, if you are not using your production to fund those things, they will kill you. That's the outcome of not paying your taxes for their nonsense. And the only option they give you is to pick one of their two absolutely idiotic candidates who just want to change exactly how many brown people they kill in exactly which country. Nothing ever actually meaningfully changes. Walmart always gets the subsidy. There's always special privilege. Everybody, you're still funding all of their goals. You're just funding person's A goal and all of their friends versus person B's goal and all of their friends. And they're just marketing to you which one they think you should pick for them. So the ability to break the rule of taxation is as powerful as the ability to break the rule of inflation. To be able to hide the value that you produce so that those who would like to confiscate it cannot either find it or even prove that you have it is likely to be a very serious driving force in Bitcoin, particularly because there are so many different jurisdictions. There are so many different meticulous, nonsense-specific rules in capital controls across the world. So absolutely regardless of what your personal opinion is about whether or not someone else should be funding this particular set of goals for the government, or this particular war, it doesn't really matter, because, you know, your opinion and my opinion, like my opinion of what you should be funding should not matter, because it's your money. Like why should you be subject to my, like let's say you hated Bitcoin and I wanted you to invest in Bitcoin. Why the hell would I have any say over like whether or not you invested in Bitcoin? Like, what an arbitrary, subjective bunch of nonsense. That's pretty much the whole of, you know, what government does. It's just a bunch of idiotic investments that continue to not pay off and not actually do. I mean, they never actually produce the results that they say they're going to produce. I mean, how many thousands of times has government, quote, fixed healthcare with some law that has done nothing to, like, where is the fix? Is healthcare fixed in this country? Talking about the U.S. here, I know there's a lot of people who are not U.S. who listen to this. So that's the lens I'm putting all of this through. But regardless, this is a powerful bit of sovereignty to have. To be able to give someone, for someone to literally have that option of what is essentially limited to the wealthy for creating an overseas account, or, you know, buying a plot of land on some random island somewhere that has, you know, is a tax-free haven, and that they could just set up all of their businesses and build this huge legal barrier. To have that option to the person who has $50. To give that option to the poorest in a nation, or just the middle class, to give that option to the middle class, who are the most beaten by all of the funds, all of the confiscation. The inflation hits the middle class the worst, or at least to the greatest magnitude. Taxes hit the middle class the worst. All of these things These people have never had an out. They've never had a defense. The wealthy always have a defense. In fact, the wealthy are usually the beneficiaries of all of that. They're the ones that get the billion-dollar subsidies. They're the ones that run their businesses like shit and then get $800 billion bailouts while the middle class loses their houses. That's absolutely criminal. That's so the corruption there is so unbelievable that somebody can run their business like crap. They can drive themselves into unpayable liabilities and that you will pay for it through inflation and taxation so that they can stay in business. How could you ever expect the financial industry to punish bad behavior for it to actually be responsible and to actually behave, to actually back the funds with something of value to protect the customers when bad behavior is not punished, when cost is not borne by the people who implement the cost? Like if I just ran up a bunch of credit card debt and then forced all of my neighbors to pay it off, what possible reason would I have to stop running up the credit card debt? Like I could just do it again for the next 10 years and everybody will forget and we'll just do this whole process over and over again. Like what possible privilege could be more disgusting than that privilege right there to make everyone pay for your irresponsibility? That is what our financial system is right now. And all of those banks should have gone out of business and we would have had a clean, robust financial system replace it. But instead, the government worsened all of those incentives. The government paid for all of those irresponsible debts. Nobody went to jail for stealing trillions of dollars from people. It's absolutely insane. So that is another powerful monetary rule to be broken to say, yeah, I'm not going to play that game anymore. Here's my on-the-surface income. You're not going to see anything about my under-the-table income. And this doesn't just go for modern Western governments. This goes for despotic governments. This goes for countries with 90% tax rates. This goes for countries like Venezuela that just will literally starve their people before cutting back on what they are spending and releasing their hands from the throat of everybody in their country. So that is a very powerful rule to be broken, and it is being broken. So another huge lesson for Bitcoin and the cryptocurrency markets for rule breaking. And then lastly, this also puts the Silk Road in a new light because it shows that like an online darknet market for illicit goods was truly the perfect first application for Bitcoin because it's an immediate advertisement like for saying like Bitcoin does break the rules. Look, like this is what was once only really possible with an in-person cash-dominated market is now a viable online digital cash-dominated market. And even after so many shutdowns, exit scams, and like huge multinational drug enforcement crackdowns, the online markets are still thriving. If you check out deep.web, I think it's deep.web.com, or is it? This is not deep period web. It's deep dot web spelled out. But it's like a news site and a community keeping up with everything on the darknet markets. And it's really fascinating to read if you're looking into like those kind of breaking the rules things and like looking at like how these markets actually survive and what's going on. It's like my Bitcoin soap opera thing. It's so much fun to keep up with what's going on those because it's all. And the entire thing is nothing but rule breaking. So I encourage you to actually read some of the news items and goings on with the darknet market because it's really fascinating stuff. And it's always exciting because it's illicit markets. So there's always something insane going on over there. But I think it's also important to remember that this isn't just about, you know, one country. This isn't about like, you know, some like weak-ass U.S. capital controls or something, because the U.S. is really not that bad in the grand scheme of things. So you have to remember just how many different rules and jurisdictions there are out there. Like, one country may have very little capital controls or cross-border payment limitations, and they might not really care, like, for certain types of business that you're doing. But the country next door may have thousands of ridiculous, costly, and deeply specific rules for moving money. They may limit you in all kinds of different ways and tell you who you can do business with specifically, and reverse payments that go to people that they don't disagree with, or block accounts and shut down accounts of political dissidents or political opposition. These jurisdictions are everywhere, and Bitcoin and cryptocurrency, decentralized monetary networks, are a tool for tearing down that exact type of border and set of rules. And to do so in the online world and allow people to do business without the protocol itself even knowing or caring about the jurisdictions through which it's traveling or boundaries it's jumping across. I mean, Bitcoin has no idea whether it's in Japan or the US. And technically, when you were talking about the blockchain, the Bitcoin is in all of those countries all at once. And I think that's the ultimate goal of Bitcoin, is to have a global monetary system that does not care one iota about local jurisdictions or rules. It's a global set of consensus rules and that allows value to flow freely and without arbitrary limitations, without stupid politically biased limitations or identity politics limitations or ideological limitations, not arbitrary subjective human nonsense, but limitations like, okay, well, there's only so much bandwidth we can do to reach consensus. Engineering limitations and software limitations, not subjective human limitations. And this requires verifiable consensus across even the most limiting and despotic boundaries in the world. So for a global network to function, it must talk across all of these borders. And that's why the block size is such an important safety and security feature. If Bitcoin cannot work over Tor and with low bandwidth ad hoc solutions, then it cannot break the capital control rules of powerful nations. It can't reach consensus across those despotic borders, which makes it useless. If verifiability is not able to be achieved within some specific jurisdiction or country, then it's not assisting, it's not helping anybody in that country it's not giving them an alternative to the rule set that they're already stuck in. So in the end, this is a very long roundabout way of going through the rules that I think Bitcoin is breaking, but I think it's a powerful lesson for Bitcoin and crypto in general that this game is about breaking rules, which is why I think privacy should be a top concern and why it's something that I talk about on the show a lot. I think it's why decentralized exchanges, at least I'm hoping, could very well be a big part of this ecosystem in the future, even though I openly admit that none of them are really there now. And also, it's why I think actually gambling, which is not something I've talked about really on the show, but I think it's good to consider that gambling is really something that we should embrace as well, at least as a development community and stuff. Like, but I think that will kind of come with custom contracts and like HTLCs. There's a lot there, particularly with the Lightning Network, that can be extended just to make small modifications to kind of the Lightning Network contracts and payments that I think can be applied to a ton of things like simple gambling or Oracle services for, you know, events, for verifying events and that kind of stuff. So there's a whole lot going on, but I think this was part two was a particularly exciting piece of this for going into why exactly decentralization is useful and why we should care about it. Like, because I think Simon is right here. This is about breaking the rules. With that, I guess we will close this here with the excellent part 2 of 4 for BitTorrent Lessons for Crypto by Simon Morris. Again, I will link to this Medium page and the rest of the, which you can find the rest of the series up there, and drop some major applause on this one because I thought this was a really great discussion, and I think he's right. If you're not breaking rules, you're doing it wrong. So do not forget to come back tomorrow with part 3. Do not forget to follow Simon Morris and drop some major applause on this article. All those links will be available in the show notes and on the Twitter post. And of course, follow me on Twitter at The Crypto Economy and check out cryptoeconomy.life for more awesome reads, articles, discussions, and interviews about all of this cool ass stuff. All right, guys. I will catch you all back here tomorrow with part 3 of BitTorrent Lessons for Crypto. Take it easy, guys.
This podcast is a part of the C-Suite Radio Network. For more top business podcasts, visit c-suiteradio.com.